Did you like the record warmth yesterday, ladies and gentlemen? So did I. What a day. What was it? 63 degrees in the metro area. That tops the previous record of 55 set some years ago. But can you believe it? And you probably can, because we live in a wacky part of the world. Come this next Friday, according to the National Weather Service latest forecast, we're looking at snow with a high of 35 degrees. Good afternoon. Dare I say good afternoon? Well, let's enjoy it while we've got it. Stan Turner here with you. Thank you so much for your company here on the show here. We've been doing this thing here for about 11, 12 years and bringing you interesting people with interesting stories, all true, and we can't do it without you. Happy to have you with us. And Jesse, happy to have you with us. You brought your wonder dog, Daisy, into the studio today.
Yes,
so
I
did. So happy
to
have a mascot here who's definitely on our side, right?
Absolutely.
What a sweet little lady she is. Always nice to have a bow wow at your foot. We're doing radio work here, folks. Well, here we are. We have some important duties, and I think you're going to find it not only informative, but very, very interesting. Let's begin this way. If you've ever been in military combat, you know the faces, because you were one of those faces. Tense, focused, and young. Very very young. If you are fortunate enough never to have been in combat, you get a look at these young soldiers' faces in the movies, and some of them very realistic. Combat veterans are the best judge of this, and they generally give good grades to warrior portrayals in such films as Saving Private Ryan. If you saw that film, you will likely not forget the opening scenes of the D-Day landings on June 6th, 1944. Jesse, you've seen the film, have you not?
Many times.
Yeah. It was a cauldron of death, dying, ultimate Allied success, and again, very young faces. Consider this, if you will, from the actual D-Day landings that day in the American first wave at Utah Beach. One face was decidedly un-young, downright old in comparison to the others. There he was, dressed for war. A man 56 years of age, arthritic, using a cane, a walking stick, to get around amid the hellfire of the landing beach. He had just had a bout of pneumonia, had a diseased heart, yet he was rallying the young kids, our brave and determined and frightened young troops. This old man wore the star of a brigadier general on his soldier. This man was Theodore Roosevelt Jr., son of the former U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt, old TR. There is so much more to this man than battlefield heroics. It seems history has largely forgotten Ted Roosevelt Jr., who lived the first part of his life in the considerable shadow of his hard-to-ignore father, Teddy, old TR. But now, thanks to an excellent new biography, we get a full-bodied, well-balanced, and immensely readable account of Ted Jr. We have Twin Cities author Tim Brady to thank for this. Tim has been on this program before, telling us other fascinating true stories of men and war and the oh-so-thin line that separates survival and oblivion. Tim Brady, nice to have you back again, sir. Thank you.
Glad to be here, Stan.
Thank you so much. We're going to move your microphone in just a little bit. You soft-spoken
right.
Irishman, you there. Tim, you have just put together some amazing books, some stories. 12 Desperate Miles, you wrote about a banana boat that was conscripted.
That was a very interesting story. It was conscripted to serve in the invasion of North Africa.
A banana boat. You got to read that one, folks, if you haven't. So we had Tim on talking about that. Oh, it's been a couple, 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And then your follow-up, A Death in San Pietro.
Yes.
On the Italian campaign in World War II.
Yes. And highlighted the story of Ernie Pyle, the famed
my hero
war
as a journalist.
Correspondent. Yeah.
Just a great story.
Yeah.
And the intersecting lives of John Huston, the great film director and producer. And this wonderful, beloved Army captain.
Captain Henry Wasco of Texas, who became the subject of Pyle's most famous World War II column, A Death in San Pietro.
Tim, thank you for doing these stories, and thank you for doing this next one now that is out there on the shelves.
My pleasure. I enjoy writing every one.
This one is called His Father's Son, The Life of General Ted Roosevelt Jr. You know, Tim, when we think of Roosevelts, I think we usually think of the big three.
We
Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, and wife Eleanor.
Exactly. Before I got engrossed in the story of Ted Jr., those were the three that I knew about and had read of and, mm-hmm. and had looked at. I got involved in the Ted Jr. story after reading just of the thing that you introduced this segment with, the story of his participation in the D-Day invasion, a 56-year-old man, son of not just a president, yeah. but a president whose visage was on a mountain in South Dakota. And I asked myself, why would this man, who had nothing to gain and had already participated in other harrowing circumstances, why would he be doing this? And that was really the jumping off point for my interest in the subject.
Good question, and you have provided us with a story that answers that. It's just an amazing tale. Now, you know what, Tim Brady, to know the son, Ted Jr., we really need to know the father. And if you, this is unfair to ask you this, but if you could give us an overview of TR, of Teddy Roosevelt, the president.
Ted Roosevelt, the president, was just the most dynamic person who's probably ever sat in that office.
Even more than the current occupant, dynamic.
I would say so.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about dynamics here.
Yes,
we're, color.
Yes. Theodore Roosevelt was. The youngest president to occupy the office. He took the office after rising quickly he was a hero of the Spanish-American War in 1898. Came home, got elected to the governorship of New York. Was raised from that office to the vice presidency with the election of William McKinley in 1900. McKinley was assassinated in just months after that election, and Ted became president in 1901. And from there he became legend. He served for the next 8 years as president, and was just a huge figure on the American scene, on the world scene, was just a real dynamic figure.
The old cliche, bigger than life, it really fits with Teddy Roosevelt. We see him, the pictures of him with the glasses, with almost looks like a monocle, but it's not, but the strap hanging off the one side.
Yeah, there's really so much to his life. It's hard to boil down. But there was a preamble to all of this story. And he had a large family. The large family occupied the White House beginning in 1901, and they became a source of immense interest to the popular press.
Especially
Alice, the oldest sister.
A loose canonet.
Yes, she was. Alice was the daughter of Theodore and his first wife, who died tragically soon after giving birth to Alice.
So we've got this gigantic figure, Teddy Roosevelt, the president, and he and his wife have six kids, one by the previous marriage, but four sons.
Yes,
Ted Jr., Kermit, Archie, and Quentin. Ted being the eldest, the firstborn.
Ted was the eldest, yes.
There probably went with it, more than probably, there went with it a special burden in the eyes of his father.
There was. Ted was sort of like his father physically as a child and as a young man. They were both small-framed and had to work to overcome some physical disabilities. Ted Jr. had a wayward eye, and he was being picked on quite regularly for that and his small frame. He became a battler and a kid who frequently got into fights with schoolyard buddies and bullies. And
well, he was encouraged not to shy away or back down from a fight.
And Ted, his father, Ted's father, I'm going to distinguish Ted Jr. and Theodore for the
father. We'll call Theodore the former president.
Theodore. Would on the one hand talk about the only participating in these scuffles if there was some fairness issue involved, a moral issue. On the other hand, he was constantly offering his sons lessons in how to defend themselves and their honor and
manly art of self defense.
Exactly.
You have in your book here his father's son, the life of General Ted Roosevelt Jr., a painful photograph of Ted Jr. being helped off the football field, a freshman game, I think 1905, between his school, Harvard, and Yale.
Yeah.
And this kid, I'll tell you, having a backbone and the ability to get in there and give it everything he's got, this little guy across the line from these bigger Yale guys, and they just teed off on him. And he was just beaten bloody, literally.
Yeah. Well,
you can see the pain on his face, but he wouldn't give up.
He wouldn't. As a consequence of his size and the demeanor, he developed this toughness and was truly just someone who wouldn't give up. Went out for the Harvard freshman football team as a 135-pound defensive end, and the big powerhouse at the time in college football was Yale, and Yale had real big men on their line, and they just, as you said, they pounded him and pounded him and pounded him some more, and he stayed in the game throughout, and it was only late in the fourth quarter that he became this figure that you described, being hauled off the field without the use of his legs, and just he looked like one of the figures in the American Revolution.
The bandage around the head. And he won the admiration of the opposing team too.
He did this throughout his life. He was always
the mold is being set here, isn't it?
Yeah, he was always winning the admiration of others for his plucky resolve and toughness.
But nobody was handing him anything, really.
No,
he had to go out and do this.
And he didn't want it to be handed to him. He was always very sensitive to the fact that he was a Roosevelt and didn't want special favors.
One of President Roosevelt's biographers had, I think, something nasty to say, and you quoted in the, I think it's in the epilogue of your book here, Edmund Morris, Theodore Rex. He wrote a series of books on it.
Yeah.
He had this rather unflattering portrayal of Ted, the son. Ted, at age 15, as having all of his father's purposeful force, but imagination and intellect were denied him. He was small, nervous, grim, plug ugly.
Yeah,
that was a
hard description of Ted.
Unfair?
He was not a handsome man, and he, in his early years, he didn't display a lot of studiousness, and his intellect was he tended to hide his intellect. So there was much that was unfair about the description, but there were hints that he was he had some of the qualities described there.
This is kind of an underdog who is well born, but you still root for him, don't you?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, money can't buy you everything, can it?
Exactly.
Sometimes it comes at a terrible cost.
And there are people who elevated Ted and who, by admiring him, I'm thinking particularly of his wife, Eleanor, who saw in Ted qualities that others didn't see and helped to lift him.
We are going through the life of an amazing figure, not the Theodore Roosevelt most of us think about, but his eldest son, Ted Jr., a remarkable study in courage and disappointment and resolution, all of the good qualities and all the feet of clay there, too, some of it, too. It's an amazing tale.
Yeah.
When we get to his military exploits, I think those of you who don't know much about this man, as I did not, will find that this is an inspiring story, to say the least. The man who has written a wonderful biography biography of Ted Roosevelt Jr., who is with us in studio, Tim Brady with us. We're going to take a quick break here, come back with more on Ted Roosevelt Jr. right after this.
Jaime's Haberdashery presents The Jaime's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's Oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com. Please join me, Stan Turner, as we play your requests, share your special dedications, and just have a lot of fun. It's the Wolf Brewing Company All Request and Dedication Show with me, Stan Turner, weekdays noon to 2 on Club 1220 KLBB. We are back, and we are tracing the life of a remarkable American, Ted Roosevelt Jr., eldest son of T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, the guy who wrote up San Juan Hill, or a hill next to it, right?
Yes.
Did he ride up or did he walk up? Did he charge up?
He started riding and wound up on foot.
On foot, okay. Yeah. Exposing himself to gunfire and all the rest, just like his son would do.
Yeah, it was a genuine act of courage and bravery.
Crazy. Well, we're talking about the son here, focusing on Ted Roosevelt Jr., the subject of a new book by our guest here in studio, Tim Brady. Name of the book just out, His Father's Son, The Life of General Ted Roosevelt. So he gets through Harvard, okay.
Yes.
Wasn't a brilliant student. I don't think his mind was focused. It didn't seem to be on academics at the time.
No, it wasn't. He started out more interested in his football career and wound up more interested in fly fishing.
Fly fishing. The way most of us go, at least until somebody catches us. Okay. Yeah. So he does get through Harvard, okay. Ted Roosevelt Jr. does. And so he's looking for work afterwards for a career.
Yes.
And looking around, and you'd think maybe, the old man, politics and all the rest, but no, he winds up, he almost came to Minnesota to work with the mining industry.
Yeah, he spent a summer before his last year at Harvard in northern Minnesota working for one of the mining companies up there. And when he came back, when he went back east, he talked with his father about the distinct possibility of returning the following year after his graduation to begin a career out in Minnesota.
Hmm.
That soon died down and went to the back burner in his mind. And after he graduated, what he did, in fact, was go to Connecticut, where he started to work on the floor of a carpet factory.
Carpet factory. Doing some of the grunge work, too. He didn't shy from doing the menial stuff.
No, it was, it's one of these things when you talk about, this was still the president's eldest son, so it wasn't as if he was doing this anonymously. It was just impossible. So he went, to work on the factory floor at menial labor. He was also being covered. His weekends were being covered by the New York Times.
So. This guy in the carpet factory gets New York Times coverage, huh?
Yeah.
And yeah.
But he was a serious employee. He did the job, and he started to develop skills for the carpet trade. He was said to have developed a good hand, which is I don't know the carpet business myself, but I'm assuming that's just the feel of the carpet helps determine its quality,
and I'm
sure that that's what the good hand is about.
He had that touch, and as you mentioned here, because he is the son of this famous man, he attracts press attention, as the whole family did, and I think the father called the news photographers Kodak creatures, right? Always swarming around the Roosevelt family.
I like that phrase. Yeah. Kodak creatures, and some Roosevelts liked that attention, others didn't. Okay. Alice, the oldest sister, really relished it, but the boys tended not to like it so much.
Alice relished any attention she could get. She was kind of, as I say, the loose cannon of the family, no doubt about it. Well, we get, there is a parting of the ways between Ted Jr. and the carpeting industry.
Yeah.
And also, he starts to get his first taste of military training, too.
He did, and this was just prior to America's entry into World War I. The Roosevelt family, beginning with the father, were strong advocates for American entry into the war. And Ted Jr. took that to heart, and he and his brothers began training at they were sort of officer training camps for gentlemen soldiers, Wall Street bankers,
the moneyed class,
the money
and they
class.
Paid their own way in
they
there.
They paid
for the
their
training.
Own way, and they went to these camps, which actually were ultimately a service to the American Army during the war, because they did help establish a sort of officers training corps.
Kind of a forerunner of ROTC, ROTC.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Ted was a part of that in New York.
Right. So the war, World War One, the Great War, as they called it in Europe, began in August of 1914. A lot of people forget America did not get into the fight until April 1917.
Exactly.
But when we got in, we got in. And the father, T.R., I think he wrote to Pershing, General John Pershing, Blackjack, and said, I got four sons here. Get them in. Get them over to Europe and into the fight.
Exactly. Ted and Quentin, who was the third son, went in the first wave. They actually arrived with Pershing and the remnants of the 1st Division in the first wave in I believe it was early June 1917. They were in France from there, Ted.
He begins to flower, doesn't he?
He does.
He comes alive on the battlefield in a very real way.
He turns out to be a natural military leader and a natural military leader from the company level and the battalion level on up. Again, he has this Roosevelt stigma, or he saw it as a stigma, as having to prove himself to other men, and he set out to do that and did it. He became a great leader of a 1st Division battalion, ultimately.
He led from the front, didn't he, as a real leader would do.
He was the type who he really in many ways he's reminiscent of a throwback to a 19th century sort of military figure because he did lead from the front and he was always unafraid of taking charge in a battle, taking the charge.
Is it true that he had great empathy with his men? He cared deeply about the men
he did,
who served under him.
The Roosevelt family was interesting in that regard. They personally, they were not rich. They had to.
Sagamore earn. Hill looked like a wealthy man's.
it did.
Oyster
and
Bay,
and
New York.
I want to put a little asterisk.
Okay.
I mean, it was a they were class, but they were not personally wealthy or familiarly wealthy.
Okay.
Meaning that Theodore had to earn a living to keep the family in maids and that sort of thing, Ted likewise, but all of the boys, that was on the one hand. On the other hand, they were always very democratic in their outlook, and this you can see in the progressive politics of Theodore and the rest of the Roosevelts, which meant to them the army was the ultimate democratic institution, and Ted set out to prove democratic theories through his participation in the army.
So there he is, exposing himself, to gunfire, to shellfire, like the rest of his men. Is it true, Tim Brady, that Ted Roosevelt Jr. looked around and saw that his men needed combat boots, and that he bought boots out of his own finances for the entire battalion?
I've heard the story. I've never heard that story.
Okay,
but
right.
but he it, soon after he arrived, his wife Eleanor was in France at the same time, which is another story. But Eleanor was working for the YMCA, and one of the first things Ted did when he arrived with his battalion in a little village in France was to write to Eleanor back in Paris with a long list of items that included sports gear and tobacco and everything that an infantryman would mm-hmm. need or want for a better life
in the trenches. Yeah. What about Ted Roosevelt Jr.'s battlefield heroics?
He was, as I said before, out there, he was with his men. He was in the First World War. He was gassed. He was shot. He was seriously wounded in one of the first actions of the American forces in the war. He was on the front lines, and he mm-hmm. was always there serving mm-hmm. with his men.
And his men admired him.
And they admired him.
His brother Quentin falls. He is an aviator. He's into a scrap with Germans, and yeah. tell us what happened.
Quentin was a kid. He was 18 years old. He had gone straight from Harvard to France, and there's an interesting backstory. Quentin was sort of the golden boy of the mm-hmm. Roosevelt family. Everyone seemed to like Quentin, and everyone saw in Quentin some of the star qualities that they hadn't seen in, frankly, in Ted or Archie or mm-hmm. Kermit, too. And so he was a lot of people, though he was just a kid, a lot of people thought he was going to be the Theodore.
He had all of his father's good qualities and apparently none of the bad ones. At least yeah. that was the perception.
Yes, mm-hmm. yeah. But he was also... The Roosevelt boys were hard on each other, and they were competitive. And Quentin got over to France and couldn't get up in the air. He was a flyer. He'd learned to fly. But the American Air Force, which was part of the Army at the time, was a new institution at the time. They couldn't practice flying because no one wanted to. They didn't have enough planes from American manufacturers to fly, and the French, who had plenty of planes, didn't want to lend them to these new American pilots. And so it took a long time for Quentin to even get in the air. And so he was there in the middle of the winter 1917-18, and it wasn't until June that he got up in the air with American planes, and he had only been flying for a couple of weeks when he dove into this basically a mess up in the air with where he found himself being trailed by a couple of German pilots and got hit and zeroed out.
And crashed to his death. I guess you could get no finer acclamation than from your enemy. I'm going to read just a bit
sure.
of what the German aviators had to say from that dogfight. These are the German words. The aviator of the American squadron, Quentin Roosevelt, is trying to break through the air zone over the Marne. Met the death of a hero. A lively air battle began in which one American, Quentin, in particular, persisted in attacking. These are words from his German foes.
Yeah.
They buried him with full military honors, too.
They did. He was saluted by the Germans. He was saluted by the American forces on the ground. And he became, you know, sort of one of the many tragic figures
sure.
Of the war, especially to his father.
I want to ask you about that. Yeah. It impacted the father, of yeah. course, as yeah. you'd expect, but greatly. And what about Ted Jr. losing his kid brother?
You know, Ted was he was not a guy who showed a lot of emotion, and he stifled his emotion in that case. But he ultimately he got together a couple of months after the death of Quentin. We got together with both Kermit and Archie in Paris in this apartment that Eleanor, his wife, had obtained in the city, and they suddenly had a night where all of them hit the bistros and cafes of Paris
and drank a toast or five to
wound up to in the streets. Yeah, knocking against the curbs and
kind of a catharsis too, losing that boy.
It was, I think.
They loved him.
They loved him. Yeah, there was a deep love among all of the members of the Roosevelt family. There was, as I said, there was competition. There was there were some resentments that would develop over time, but. They loved each other, and losing Quentin was a sad thing.
And the father never really got over it, did he?
He didn't. He was not in good health that year. This is 1918. He was not in good health from the beginning of that year to the end, and it was made immeasurably worse by the death of Quentin. And also the realization that this war that he had so advocated for had taken such a great toll on the family. His son Archie was grievously wounded in April of that year. Archie was really never the same after the war either. Ted, aside from being gassed, was battling in the city of Soissons in France and got shot through and through in the knee. And this is one of the reasons he was lugging a cane around
on D-Day.
so he was laid up for months, and it was a tough year, a tough war.
Tough year. I'm going to back up a little bit. T.R., the father, of course, was president. He became president. And Jesse, if we can get this little clip we've got of T.R. ready to go here. Theodore Roosevelt came to the White House, the presidency, on the assassination, as you mentioned, of William McKinley, and then stood for election and won, and then four-year term, and then he was gone. He was out of office then, but would reemerge in 1912, I think, as a third-party candidate, progressive or so-called Bull Moose Party.
Yeah.
Let's listen to the voice of the former president here, and the would-be president again, Theodore Roosevelt.
The present condition of living cannot be accepted as satisfactory. There are too many who do not prosper enough, and of the few who prosper greatly, there are certainly some whose prosperity does not mean welfare for the country. Rational progressives, no matter how radical, are well aware that nothing the government can do will make some men prosper, and we heartily approve the prosperity, no matter how great, of any man if it comes because of his rendering service to the community.
Okay, that's Theodore Roosevelt right there, campaigning as a progressive. And a great orator. In fact, he did some of that orating at the Minnesota State Fair, didn't he?
He did. Yep. He did.
And they walk softly and carry a big stick.
That was delivered at the State Fair, yeah.
We might, and again, this program in your book is about the son, the eldest son, but just one final aside about T.R. That year, 1912, at one campaign stop, he was shot in the chest.
He was in Milwaukee, and it was a remarkable moment. He was shot through his speech, I believe, and the speech was folded over.
Must have been a thick, long speech.
I think it was. He survived.
And his glass case deflected the
glass,
shot, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And not only that, he was shot early in the speech, which I think was in excess of an hour, and stood there delivering. Completed it, yes.
Theodore Roosevelt. Of such stuff was his sons made, huh?
Yeah. Yes.
The war, World War One, is over finally, and all the sons but one survive. Ted Roosevelt Jr., what happens after the war?
The first thing he did, he had the beginning of a political career, and perhaps you could mark the beginning by his involvement in the founding of the American Legion. He was one of the people who was instrumental, if not the most instrumental in founding the service. He got involved and would have been acclaimed the president of the first meeting of the mm-hmm. American Legion.
But he said no.
He was very sensitive to his standing as a Roosevelt. He knew that he wanted to get into politics, and he didn't want to take advantage of the veterans who had formed the American Legion with him. Okay. And so he said, please do not make me president by acclaim. I'm going to be running for office, mm-hmm. which he soon did.
And here we have then the intersection, this internecine fight among the Roosevelt family. You've got the Oyster yeah. Bay, Long Island, New York Roosevelts, and you've got the Hyde Park, upstate New York Roosevelts, yeah. they being Democrats, the Teddy Roosevelt types being yeah. Republicans, yeah. and they don't like each other.
Well, they started out without bitterness or rancor. Franklin was a great admirer of his fifth cousin, Theodore. Though, as you said, Franklin was a lifelong Democrat, Theodore was a lifelong Republican. Both were progressives, however, but the bitterness came in 1920 when the Democrats chose Franklin to be the vice presidential nominee of the party that year, and the Republican Party, probably quite rightly, saw this as a cynical move on the part of the Democrats to take advantage of the Roosevelt name and help promote their interest in the campaign. Franklin had been the Secretary of the Navy in World War I, but he was not a hugely known politician in his right. Theodore, on the other hand, had just died and remained immensely popular. And Theodore had this whole covey of sons, and it was not easy for the American public to distinguish a son from a fifth cousin. So the Democrats were thought to be taking advantage of that when they named Franklin as their nominee.
The political plot thickens here among the Roosevelts. We're going to take a break talking with Tim Brady, author of the new book, His Father's Son, The Life of General Ted Roosevelt, Jr. Back after this. At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller, great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com. Hello, this is Stan Turner, and I'd like to personally invite you to join me on a tour of Normandy, London, and Paris, September 7th through the 17th. We'll tour some of the most important sites of World War II. We'll stay in London, and you'll be able to explore wartime London with a visit to Churchill's War Rooms and London's Imperial War Museum. We'll visit the D-Day Museum in Portsmouth, the only museum in Britain dedicated to telling the story of Operation Overlord and all aspects of the D-Day invasion. These are just a few of the highlights of our 10-day, 9-night tour of Normandy, London, and Paris. Airfare, transportation, and daily breakfast and dinner are included. However, seating is limited. To join me, please call Michael at Defined Destinations, 651-398-9358. That's 651-398-9358. Or go online to defineddestinations.com.
Jaime's Haberdashery presents The Jaime's Oath.
On my honor, I will dress my best, be clean in my speech and actions, live my life honestly, take care of my body for good build and fit, to help keep my country strong by supporting local merchants. Through the words and actions of my haberdasher, I will trust.
So, gentlemen, will you take the Jaime's Oath? Jaime's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street, downtown St. Paul, at Jaime's.com.
Did you know Wolf Beer has a brewing history that stretches back to the 1860s? Did you also know that Wolf Brewing Company has a baseball heritage as well? Yep, it's true. In fact, in the early 1900s, the Wolf Brewing Company fielded a team that would regularly beat teams from the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. And while fans were watching great baseball, they would ask for Wolfs. So when you're listening to great baseball, do the same. Ask for Wolfs, Stillwater's original craft beer. Wolf Brewing Company, Stillwater, Minnesota.
We are back here. Tim Brady, our guest this noon hour, author of His Father's Son, The Life of General Ted Roosevelt, Jr. What a life. And Tim Brady, you, after the show, 2 o'clock this afternoon, you will be at Valley Bookseller, one of our fine sponsors here, 2 o'clock, downtown Stillwater, Valley Bookseller, to meet and greet the people.
Looking forward to it.
It's going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic book. I checked over there, and Kathleen Eddy and her fine corps of lady booksellers, they've got lots, stacks and stacks of your books over there. So
let's lose the stacks.
Let's do that. Let's whittle them down here. It's a great read and important story. We're going to hustle through here because time is fast fleeting here. Okay, World War I, Ted Roosevelt Jr. is wounded. He survives the war. He starts getting active politically, and he is appointed Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Yes.
And therein scandal rears its ugly head, what we came to know as the Teapot Dome scandal. If you could kindly condense that for us.
I'll do my best. It's Ted was part of the Navy. The Teapot Dome was a dome of oil that that rested in Wyoming. It actually becomes a mess that is going to be very hard to condense, but it involves big oil companies and it involves the cabinet of President Warren Harding, which turned out to be one of the most corrupt in American history, and it was oil men and cabinet men and corruption in the Roaring Twenties, basically.
No competitive bidding, and Archie and Ted Jr. were both smeared a little bit. They got their skirts dirty, but they were ultimately acquitted of any wrongdoing.
They were not legally liable for any problems that arose out of the Teapot Dome.
Okay. We're going to jump ahead here and in some important territory. Ted Roosevelt, he becomes associated with, he had a position in Puerto Rico, did he? Yeah.
Yes, he was the Governor General of Puerto Rico.
Between
the wars and the Philippines.
Okay.
And in succession under Herbert Hoover in that administration, he was recalled from the Philippines in 1933 by Cousin Franklin, who had just assumed office and as stated earlier, Franklin was a Democrat and wanted his own people in the Philippines. And when Ted was called home, the press asked him about his relationship with Franklin. Yep. And Ted's quote was, "I am a fifth cousin about to be removed."
That's a great line. It really was. And FDR's wife, Eleanor, just tar brushed Ted Roosevelt Jr.
Yeah,
for the Teapot Dome and all the rest.
Yeah,
so there was open warfare in the Roosevelt branches.
Ironically, both Ted and Franklin had wives named Eleanor.
That's right.
And Franklin's Eleanor and Ted were political enemies and rivals through Franklin's career onward.
September 1939, Europe is in war. America gets into it December 7th, 1941, and the Roosevelt, Mr. Roosevelt Jr., gets into it, too.
Ted was Ted and sister Alice even more so than Ted, were part of the America First movement, which has gotten some recent political attention.
Yes.
And the America First movement was an anti-war movement initially. The the Nazi affiliations and anti-Semitic connotations arose in time with the America First movement, but initially it was primarily just an anti-war movement. People did not want people, meaning including Ted and Alice, were frightened of the consequences of being involved in a war in Europe.
And then came Pearl Harbor, and that turned that thinking around.
It did rather quickly. Ted was never a pacifist, and he wanted to make that distinction. He was always more than. In fact, it was a Roosevelt family mantra. Service was a Roosevelt family mantra, and Ted was always willing to serve, and in particular, take up arms.
And he did. He gets in uniform again, goes to his first assignment, North Africa.
He was part of the Operation Torch, and Ted did his first beachside landing in North Africa in Algeria.
Mm-hmm. And he distinguishes himself. He's leading again from the front.
Yeah.
Okay, then from there, what, Sicily, then Italy?
Well, he was deeply involved in the battles in North Africa.
Right.
And
I don't mean to be skimming through these
No,
he
I know that.
Much, yeah.
He served in North Africa from November 42 to the invasion of Sicily in June 43, battled his way through Sicily and then was sort of unceremoniously dumped.
Thank you, Mr. Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Patton.
Yes, General George Patton.
Yeah, and then was sort of sent over to Italy to serve as a liaison officer between French and Italian and French and American troops in the new alliance that was forming.
Tim Brady, let's fast forward to the prelims before D-Day, June 6, 1944. So Teddy is over to England getting ready, and he has one burning desire.
He wants to be in the first wave at D-Day.
He's how old then? 56?
He's 56 years old.
And he's not lame. Well, he is lame in a way.
He's not only lame, but he's unbeknownst to most everyone, actually everyone but himself. He'll later confess this to his own son, Quentin. He's been feeling these chest pains from late spring through the invasion, and he has also just got out of a sick bed. He had pneumonia, a severe case of pneumonia, just as he arrived in England. He's not in good shape, but his commander, he's now in the 4th Division, is a man named Tubby Barton, and he pleads with Tubby Barton to let him be involved in the first wave at D-Day. And his arguments are
sound.
He says, I am the son of a president. It's all the arguments that they sort of work both ways. He says, this is my third major amphibious landing. I know how to do this. I have done this before. People just don't have a lot of experience.
He was right.
And he was right. And he said, think of what it will mean to these young men, these young soldiers going ashore if they see me, the son of a president, involved in this invasion.
So General Barton Tubby finally acquiesces and said, okay, all right.
He says, go to it. Though Tubby thought, I will never see this man alive again. And bon voyage.
Farewell.
And most everyone thought this is sort of a death sentence.
Well, for all of them, too, really.
Yeah,
the young grunts, too. Well, okay, comes D-Day, the morning of, it's about 6:30. There's Ted Roosevelt Jr. on board the ship, and he waves off a soldier who tries to give him a helping hand to get into the landing craft. I can do it by myself.
Yes.
He's holding his cane.
Holding his cane.
56 years old, bad heart, bad knees, bad ankles. He gets in, and he does, in fact, land at Utah Beach in the first wave under heavy fire.
Yeah. Comes ashore, and he makes his way to cover and discovers, along with some other of the first waivers, that they're in the wrong place on the beach. They have the landmark that is supposed to be right in front of them. They spy way north of them on the beach, there's this question of what comes next. It's a very serious problem, because once you establish a beach landing, everyone is going to follow you there. In this particular case, they're supposed to hook up with forces who are coming from the land.
Paratroopers coming from the
landward side, and it just will screw up the whole plumb line of the invasion.
I love the way you use that in the book. But here we have this experienced man, true to his word. He was able to sort all this mess out.
Yeah.
And by the time Tubby landed, the general, he said, here's the deal. And it worked out. Another burden on Ted Roosevelt Jr., was the next landing beach over, Omaha Beach, his own son, Quentin, named after his fallen brother.
Yeah.
Quentin is landing in that hellfire.
Yeah. That's on his mind. That's on the mind. His Eleanor, Ted's wife, and Quentin's mother. It's a terrifying situation.
Back on Utah Beach, there is General, Brigadier, one-star General Ted Roosevelt Jr. He got his walking stick in one hand. Some of the accounts say he had his .45 pistol in the other. He didn't, apparently. He didn't unholster it during that first day, anyway.
No.
Finally, his Jeep, called Rough Rider, after his father's famous group name in Cuba, his Jeep comes in with Stevie, his loyal driver, and all the rest, and they make it off the beach. They start making inroads go into up towards Cherbourg Peninsula.
Yeah.
And this man is leading from the front, and a little over a month, he's sitting in a captured German truck, which becomes his command center, his mobile command center. Yeah.
He likes the command center. He's never really had such. These are luxurious accommodations for him. But he's sitting there, and his son stops in for a visit, safe and sound from his landing at Omaha. Visits, leaves that evening. Ted has a heart attack.
A fatal heart attack
and dies.
And those like General Omar Bradley and General Patton, who had been highly critical of Roosevelt for liking his regiment too much, his division too much, mm-hmm. had nothing but glowing praise. I think Bradley said, one of the bravest men he's ever known.
Yeah. The funeral took place there in France, and this whole slew of the great leaders of the Allied forces. Paused for a moment and buried Ted, and then war went on.
And Ted was supposed to receive a High Gallantry Medal, which was upgraded even from that. And what did he receive?
He won the Medal of Honor, became, along with his father and the MacArthurs, the only pair of fathers and sons to win the Medal of Honor.
Tim Brady, it's been an honor to have you on the show here. Ted Roosevelt Jr.'s legacy in a few words.
Ted was an unexplored great man. I think that his life, had he been Ted Smith, I think he would have gotten a lot more attention than if he were Ted Roosevelt Jr.
Boy, there's some irony in that, isn't there?
There is.
Tim Brady, thank you so much. The book, His Father's Son, The Life of General Ted Roosevelt Jr. Meet and greet Tim Brady at 2 o'clock at Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater this afternoon. Great book, great guy. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Stan.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Catch you at noon next Monday on the All Request and Dedication program. Jesse, thank you.